It's very difficult to maintain unity, let alone even getting it in the first place. Especially when it comes to something as controversial as Christianity, as religion, as the kinds of core belief system that we're trying to share and be a part of. The world looks at Christianity, and what do they see in regards to unity? I mean, really, we know it's just all over. There are denominations, which inherent in that word is an idea of division of some kind. We can't agree on hardly anything. And people who can't agree often do not get along, and we divide. We've seen it among churches of Christ in our areas, perhaps. We see it all the time. Christianity doesn't look like it's something that could be held for having a monopoly on unity, or doing very well with that. It's sad. I hope you know that the movement that the Church of Christ has come from was one that was motivated by people who wanted to be unified. They wanted to be simply Christians in order to bring people back together. That's what people like Alexander Campbell were trying to motivate others to do. To simply say, let's go back to the Bible. Let's try to be one again. Let's try not to be so arrogant about our opinions. To drop those and to go back to what we can all agree on. That's what we're looking for. Many of us here began in different denominations. I haven't always been a part of a non-denominational group, or I haven't always been a part of a family that was Christians. So many of us have experienced that, of trying to come together and what we all can agree on. But of course, I'm talking about more than just what we can agree on intellectually or as far as our beliefs, but actually being a family. I'm not a part of my physical family just because we agree on everything. We don't agree on everything. But there's something more to it than that. There are relationships going on, even besides what we share and what we believe. We're going to be looking in John chapter 17, but first of all, I want to start in John 20. We're going to see what Jesus prayed for the night that he was betrayed, as he was going to be crucified. We're going to see what he wanted for his disciples and for us. But just to give a flavor of what John is really about, John 20, verse 30, of course, near the end of his book, Jesus is risen from the dead, and he's going to summarize some things for us. John 20 and verse 30. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. This is why he's written this book, so that we can know who Jesus is, what he's about, we can believe in him. But there's a problem that each of the Gospels have to answer. That is, the Messiah came to a people who were fervent, who were waiting for the Messiah. They were looking for the Messiah. The Israelites were seeking. There were various people who arose claiming to be the Messiah or something like that, like claiming to be the voice out in the wilderness, like the Essenes. There were people fervently waiting for the Messiah. And yet, even though they waited fervently for the Messiah, how did they miss him? And not only did they miss him, but they crucified him. And so back in chapter 1, John chapter 1, we'll look at verse 9. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. So this is basically how John explains it. And you'll see it throughout each of the Gospels. As to how a nation who was so fervent in expectation of the Messiah missed him and killed him. Well, it's simply because they did not know him. They thought they knew him, but they did not know him. They expected something different. They wanted something different. They didn't want this Messiah who would die and live in such a life and give such teachings that they would not accept. So with that context for John, we're going to look now at his prayer in John 17. Because we won't want to just have whatever unity we want to call it. We want to have a unity that Christ sought. And we want to have the unity that the true Christ sought. Because we don't want to make the same mistake that they made, that they crucified their king. We don't want to crucify our king. If we crucify our king, we can never be unified. So let's try to understand who Christ is and see what he sought and what he wanted for his disciples and disciples to come. Just give a more narrow context. We've given context to the entire book, and now zoom in a little bit. Chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, these are all, and 17, these are all within a very close time period. They're all within the same evening. Chapter 13 is when they take the Lord's Supper, when he institutes the Lord's Supper and the Passover they have taken, and Jesus washed their feet. And ever since then, he's been talking to his disciples, and Judas has left them at the Lord's Supper. He left them, and he's there with the 11 talking. And now they're apparently from the upper room, down the Kidron Valley, over to Gethsemane, where Jesus will pray in chapter 17. So that's the context here of where they're at in this story. So Jesus is going to be betrayed. He's predicted this multiple times, that he's going to die, he's going to be rejected. This means trouble for the disciples. It means they'll be separated. I'll break it down, we'll read through it, and then we'll talk about some specific points in the text. So John chapter 17, and we'll read the first five verses. In the first five verses, you'll see he's the content is about himself, his relationship with God, and that he wants to be glorified. In verses 6 through 19, you have Jesus praying for his disciples, the 11 who are there. And then in the last verses, verses 20 through 26, he prays for future disciples, next generations, even for us. So we'll read verses 1 through 5 as he prays to be glorified. When Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you, since you have given him authority over all flesh to give eternal life to all whom you have given him. And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work that you gave me to do. And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed." Verses 6 through 16-19, he is praying for the disciples. Let's read that. "I have manifested your name to the people whom you have given me out of the world. Yours they were, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now they know that everything that you have given me is from you, for I have given them the words that you gave me, and they have received them and have come to know in truth that I came from you, and they have believed that you sent me. I am praying for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. All mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them, and I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. And I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I'm coming to you." Sorry, I just reread that. "Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. While I was with them, I kept them in your name, which you have given me. I have guarded them, and not one of them has been lost except the son of destruction, that the scripture might be fulfilled. But now I'm coming to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves." Verse 14. "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sake, I consecrate myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth." He prays for his disciples. And I'm just trying to get us familiar with what he's asking for, what he's praying for. And we'll come back and review and make some points. Verse 20, he starts praying for the disciples beyond. "I do not ask for these only, but also for those who believe in me through their word. They may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and you and me, that they may be perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them even as you loved me. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am, to see my glory that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, even though the world does not know you, I know you, and these know that you have sent me. I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. Some of the language that Jesus uses, and much of the way John writes as well, it is sometimes difficult. It's so simple, it sometimes becomes difficult, the way he speaks and writes. Jesus prays to be glorified. He prays for his disciples, and he prays for coming disciples. What do you think the emphasis of this prayer was? What do you think really stood out in this prayer? Can you boil it down to one thing, perhaps? I want you to realize one thing, for starters. The disciples are not like the world. The disciples have been called out of the world, and they know who Jesus is. He repeats that multiple times. They know who I am. They know I'm sent by you. That's the key thing that the world did not get, and that's why they crucified him, as we saw in John chapter 1. They know him. In chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16, the main concern has been that Jesus is going to leave. And the disciples don't quite understand that. That is what has been emphasized through these chapters. So just, for example, look at chapter 13, verse 36. At the beginning of these chapters, Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answered him, "Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward." And there are others who ask questions like that. We don't know the way to where you're going. Things like that. Their concern is that he is leaving, and he is trying to warn them, comfort them in regard to this. Chapter 16, verse 32 is the other end, just to try to show you that this is true for everything in between, too. Chapter 16, verse 32, just at the end, right before he's about to say this prayer. "Behold, the hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me." Along with Jesus leaving, they will be scattered. The shepherd will be struck, and the sheep will be scattered. This has been the concern for these chapters. He'll pick up on the fact that they'll be hated. He has that in chapter 15. He talks about the Holy Spirit coming, the Comforter, who'll come to them, and he will teach them, comfort them, convict the world, and speak for them. These are all ways of warning and comfort for what's coming. They're going to be scattered. If they're going to be scattered and Jesus is not going to be there, then it's fitting to have a prayer that is focused on their unity after his departure. And so, verses 1 through 5 again of chapter 17. What are the two things he actually asks for in this section? Things he actually petitions God in verse 1 and 5. You can just see he asks to be glorified. He wants to be glorified. That's how this prayer begins. It's a good way to just tell what the prayer is about by seeing what he asks for. What does that mean, though, in the context of John and of Jesus' life? What does it mean to be glorified? I hope you realize that as you study the Gospels and you study John, that simply means that he's going to go to the cross, he's going to die, he's going to be rejected, and he'll be raised. That's just one way of referring to all that. In one point, John he says he's going to be lifted up. And he says that to indicate, John says, what kind of death he's going to go through. He's going to be crucified. That is how he will be glorified. And so with that truth, the fact that he's going to be glorified, the fact that he's going to depart and be back in glory with his Father, is the pressing truth for the disciples here. Will they be able to get back together and stay together once they've been scattered? Look what he asks for in verse 11, specifically. "I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you, Holy Father. Keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. So positive, keep them in your name. Keep them in you. If you keep them in you, then they'll be one. That's what he's asking for here. Keep them together. That's what he cares about. That's what he wants. Verses 15 and... well, we'll look at verse 15 first of all. Is a part of that. It looks like it's a point that supports this idea of sticking together and how that's going to happen. Verse 15. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am out of the world. Keeping them from the evil one is one way, is a part of keeping them together. In verse 12, he mentions Judas. He was not totally kept from the evil one. He was the son of perdition. He's the one that Christ did not keep in the Father. He was not able to return back to him. Judas clearly, by going toward the evil one, is no longer one, and of course commits suicide. He's no longer one with the disciples, and he's no longer in the Father. And then verse 17 through 19, it seems to be another part of how they're going to be kept together. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sake I consecrate myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth. We can't be one. They cannot be one if they have multiple different messages to preach. If they have different gospels to preach, they cannot be unified. That's pretty simple. It's basic. And the idea of sanctifying, of consecrating, you take people and you set them apart for a purpose. It's not just arbitrary be clean and holy, but be clean and holy for a purpose, for a goal, for an aim. And if you're sanctified for a truth, then you're all set apart for this one aim, for this one truth. That's what it will take to keep these disciples unified. Very clear what Jesus is looking for here. He's looking for unity when he's glorified. He's looking for them to stay together. And then verses 20 through 23 make it very, very obvious as to what Jesus is seeking in this prayer. As all of the prayer comes together and summarized in these verses. I do not ask for these alone, but also for those who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. Just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and you in me, that they may be perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me, and love them even as you love me. Can he make that any more clear? He's making it right, that they may be one, that they may be perfectly one. And how much, to what degree, does he want them to be one? Even as Jesus is one with the Father. So he's emphasizing this. It's just as much as he can emphasize it. That they may be one, that they may be one, even as we are one. Even as we are one. So the entire prayer culminates in this emphasis. To be one even as the Father and Son are one. And why? Why? To what aim are they to be one? He says it twice in 20 through 23. So that they'll know that Jesus is from God. As they're sanctified in this truth, as they're unified, they can send a clear message and prove the message by their unity. That Jesus is from God and that they have been loved by God and Jesus has been loved by God. That's the truth. That's the truth that they've been sanctified for, that they can clearly communicate to the world if they have unity, if they stick together. Look at all it took. Look at the emphasis Jesus puts on this. Jesus isn't just talking about this. Jesus died for this. He died for this cause, for this message, for this truth. To maintain it, to start it. What are we going to do with that? He prayed for this as he's about to die. Because he knows what it takes to communicate this message. It takes the uniting of the Father and the Son. Verse 11. The end there. Remember the standard, that they may be one even as we are one. And again, he says it, of course, later on. The standard of our unity is the Father and the Son. That unity came to be rejoined when Jesus went to the cross. That unity was all about Christ's death and resurrection. That's how they came back together. That's what it takes for us to be together. That's the kind of power that's required to keep people who are so different together. I just simply would not be one with some people that I am one with because I'm a Christian. There are some people I would just never choose to spend time with or to have anything in common with, except that we have Jesus in common. Because of his sacrifice, that's what can bring us together. That's what it takes to have unity. It takes being sanctified, as we've seen. It takes being not of the world, separating ourselves. I do not understand how we can come to church, maybe grow up as Christians, and be more about other things than about our Christian family, than about the gospel. I am thankful for parents that I was able to have, whom I always knew. I always knew that they cared more about the gospel than anything else. But I saw the parents of other people who just, it was not the case. We cannot be that way. We cannot claim to try to be unified if you're more about something else other than the gospel. I know we have jobs, we have hobbies, we have interests, yes, but all of these need to be brought into submission to what we ought to really be about. And so I hope that we all would examine ourselves this week and always, continually, to continue to try to do that, to say, where am I spending my time? What are my goals? What will I do for retirement? And say, I know this is what I want to do, but how can I best put this in service to God and his kingdom? That's what we need to do. If we don't do that, then we are not sanctified in truth. We are not out of the world like we need to be. Being sanctified in the truth and being out of the world is not just about not sinning. It's not just about not drinking or being like the world in those ways. But it's so easy. It's so easy to be like the world by just simply being an American and being proud of the American dream or whatever it be, that we can be caught up in good things, family values, things like that. We have to bring those things in submission to the gospel, to that truth. If we can do that, then we can clearly communicate the truth. Then we can communicate the gospel, the thing that Jesus repeats here, so that they may believe that you sent me. If Christians are just as divisive as anyone else, what are we proving to anybody? If we bite and devour each other just as much or more than other people, what do we have to present to anyone? If we are more about keeping people out than bringing people in, what gospel are we seeking to preach? When we selfishly slander or gossip about each other, talk about each other behind people's back, we are giving people something that is not desirable. It's not the gospel. Instead, it's proving the opposite to them. It's saying, yeah, this Christ that we preach, death and resurrection, it's just death, pretty much. Because there's no life. Because we're just as divisive and selfish as anyone else.
Jesus prayed for unity, I think, knowing the difficulty that it is to keep. The controversy, the pride that can divide us is just, it's everywhere. We have to fight against it continually. But if we can do that, if we can seek to truly be unified, if we really are, then we prove the gospel to people. Because if people come here and they realize that you're not like other churches they've been to, or they're maybe not, you're maybe not like the church that maybe was here 20 years ago, I don't know. Or it's not what they grew up with, or it's not what they've seen. And if they see that you are people who really are sacrificing for each other and giving up your opinions for each other and deferring to each other, if they really see that, then you're proving to them that people can come together, die to themselves, and live for Christ. And you preach the gospel through that. I hope that you have noticed, as a warning, especially those of you who are older than I am, which is most of you, I hope that you've noticed that there was a misemphasis on something other than unity in generations past among people that are our families and our fellow Christians that we know in these areas. I hope you've noticed that some people began to exalt their opinion and their word and their interpretation as if it were on par with God's word. And began to then be divisive in that way. And when both sides do that, then you can't be right and I can't be right at the same time about this issue or that issue. And they became so proud and as if they were standing on God's good word and really they were standing on their own opinions, caused division. And it proved to their children, maybe some of you, Christianity isn't so great. I don't know how many churches, just realize, did you notice how many churches in these areas you can go to? And there's just a missing generation. Just missing. And the kids my age that have gone because they don't see Christianity for what it ought to be. They see people who care more about being right than being like Christ. Or making everyone be just like them than being like Christ. I hope we've noticed that. Because we want to stand on the truth. But we don't want to stand on just my estimation of the truth. We want to stand on God's estimation of the truth. Which is a lot more forgiving and patient than we've been. And so Christ prayed for unity. He's done so much for unity. The disciples themselves have. But there are a lot of attitudes, sinful attitudes, that just knock it down and break it so easily. And so let's think about some of these. Attitude number one here. It's just simply that it's someone else's fault. Someone else needs to put the first step forward. And someone else's responsibility to lead and pick this up. This kind of attitude of waiting for someone else or blaming others is a convincing attitude. It has some convincing parts to it, just like any lie, like I said this morning. There's always someone to blame. Is there not? Isn't there always fault on some other person? It's sometimes true that someone else needs to have a greater responsibility of some way, some greater ability, and they need to get up there and lead. Yes, that's often true, and we can point fingers. But here's why it's so far against the gospel. Sin is your fault. My sin is my fault. It's not. My sin is not your fault. It's my fault, and I need to take responsibility for it. I need to do what I need to do, regardless of whether or not you come with me. Jesus went first. If anyone could say it's their responsibility to put the first step forward, it's their fault, it was our Lord. Was it foolish? Was it weak of Jesus to stoop down for us first?
It was weak. It was foolish in our eyes, in the eyes of the world. But we can never have what we have if he did not do it. And so we kind of have this attitude of someone else needs to do this first, or they it's their fault. But to recognize our own faults and to lead where we can and take the steps we need to. The second attitude is that I just can't work with some people. You know, there's personality conflicts here. And again, this is a convincing one. And it's very convincing because we are a very personality oriented society and culture. That's how dating works. It's all about personality. What they're like, what they're into, what kind of person they are. Do we complement each other? Do we work well together? That's what it's all about. You can't conceive of things like betrothal because we're all about that personality. One of the things that's nice about it is that you can just say, our personalities don't work, instead of saying it's anyone's fault. That simply, this person's personality just doesn't work with mine. It's not my fault, not their fault. Oh well, what are you going to do? And so the best thing for me to do is to keep my distance from that person. And we both understand that. We just don't get too close. And it works okay. It appears innocent, but it is not. Many of us have either heard or spoken the words, I can't change who I am. When I first heard a Christian say that, I was rather appalled and confused. Because what are we called to, right? I can't change who I am. Jesus died to change you. He died so that I could die. Because he knew, as well as I now know, that if Mason kept living, that would be very bad. And Mason's ways, Mason's opinions, Mason's family's ways and opinions were very far off on some important things, and they needed to die. I need to change who I am. I pray that he keeps changing who I am, because I am inadequate and I'm a sinner. It ought not come from our mouths. I can't change who I am. Got to. We've been called to drop our personalities and to make them more like God. We've allowed our definition of personality to flood over into the realm of sinfulness instead. It's not just who you are. We critique it on some extremes when homosexual communities make that argument that it's just who I am, I can't change it. We critique that there, but let's critique it in our own lives, my own life. I can't. Because Christ died so that I can die and live in him. It's a message of self-denial. It's what we're called to. So the first attitude, it's someone else's fault. The second attitude, it's no one's fault. It's just this personality conflicts here. I just can't work with that kind of person. And then third, we are pretty unified. You know, we don't have too many disputes or arguments, and especially compared to what we might used to have had or other churches have, we're pretty unified since there's no arguments. Is unity to be defined as no arguments? That apparently we get along together since we can sit like civil human beings in the same building for a few hours? Is that what unity is? Is his complacency. And it fools us into thinking that things are okay just because there is no conflict. If you pile a bunch of bones on top of each other, a bunch of cold, dry bones, they will simply dwell peaceably together. But it's not alive. And while they might stick together for a while, it only takes a dog to come along to take one away. That is not a unit anymore. Or a pack of wolves to come along to tear each bone away and crush it and break it. So the same goes for a supposed body of Christians. That We might think we are a unified group because we don't argue like other churches or other generations. But we might just be a pile of limbs. And that's not a functioning body. It's a very different picture. A functioning body doesn't just dwell peaceably as a unit. It functions as a unit. Unity means harmonious service, not peaceable coexistence. It means real functioning, real work being done together, and reconciliation, that constant renewal of a body that we have to keep on getting back together, we've got to keep on reconciling, we've got to keep on doing that. That takes a lot of work, a lot of attention, a lot of consideration, a lot of prayer, a lot of will and intent. So, someone else's fault, can't work with this kind of person, or a complacent attitude that just assumes we're unified since we're not arguing. These are kinds of things that very quickly can cause a group to deteriorate, to deny the very thing that Jesus prayed for the night before, the night that he would be betrayed and crucified. We have to pay a lot of attention. We have to be very careful to not fall into these kinds of attitudes that divide us. Jesus prayed for unity, and he made it possible through the cross. And if we can do this, if we can learn to be humble and to examine ourselves to not have these kinds of attitudes, then we could function as people who bring the truth of the gospel to others. Too often churches are working too hard to even get unified in the first place, losing sight of the goal of what we're even to be once we are together. And so let's be unified, sanctified in truth, taken out of the world, so that we can share that truth. I'm afraid that too often a church can easily allow the preacher to do it, as if that's just how it's supposed to be. Elders take care of the building upkeep, and preachers do the preaching, and they just do the evangelizing, and everyone else just stands and sits and watches and puts money on the plate. But you have a vital part in the life of this congregation, in your participation with this group here, and in bringing the gospel to others. And if you're unified here, to presenting it accurately and clearly, by showing people on the outside what it's like to be a part of a unified body like Christ's.